Short disclaimer. This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted,
the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat.
This is Graham McTavish, and you are listening to Ginger and Summer on the Outlander podcast.
Welcome to episode 98 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander. So this week, I guess they say better, we are discussing chapter, look at me, I'm already ready for a read-along. We are discussing episode 116, the finale of season one of Outlander, entitled To Ransom a Man's Soul.
The opening title card is the scene at the Abbey. There's a Bible, a rosary, and some holy water. And
one of them was lavender oil.
Well, it could have been.
But it had to be the lavender oil. It looked like the same decanter that she decanted the oil into later.
It could have been, but it makes sense to be holy water.
Well, what was that third thing then?
That I don't know. It was on the left.
That could have been holy oil. Holy oil. But holy water.
The thing was wrapped in leather. I mean, I don't know.
So it was like bondage holy water?
Okay, that's a bit much. When the actual episode starts, we're at Wentworth, back in the cell. Actually, outside. The troops are presenting arms with upbeat tune and marching rhythm.
And I think that served for several... It served to show several things. Most importantly, a passage of time. I think it gave you an idea that it was the beginning of the day, because that's usually something they do every day on military installments, is that they lower the flag at night and they raise it up in the morning. Mm-hmm. So for me, that was an indication of just exactly how long Jamie has been at BJR's.
So at least one night.
At least one full night.
When the camera opens, or the scene opens on Jamie on that bed looking lost, his hand didn't look bloated, but his fingers did. I mean, they were like
swollen.
Which one?
Swollen. They both looked pretty gross.
Well, a lot of his fingers on that hand. Then the camera moves higher and we see BJR lying next to him on the bed, one hand behind his head, like he hasn't a care in the world. That was,
Well, he got what he wanted. Well,
I'm not even talking about that. I'm just saying how shocking it was for the opener. And a lot was alluded to in the last episode, but if you're a non-book reader of this series, you still may not have guessed exactly where this was going to go. The torture and the pain, yes. I mean, yes, okay, he kissed him, so maybe you were going to guess. But maybe not exactly how far it was going to go or what exactly was going to happen. But when they show him, and you quickly realize, you for sure realize later on that it's after the fact. This is the final thing. Because, well, this scene ends with him being, you know, run over by the coup.
What struck me about this whole opening is that you hear a lot about, you know, the laws of three and how things are done in threes. Like, comedy is best done in threes and, like, people always die in threes. I thought there was definitely a big three moment when this whole scene opened, because you saw... First you saw his hand, and then it panned up to his vacant, dead expression, his traumatized expression, and then it panned up even further to naked Tobias Menzies. So it was like 1, 2, 3. It was like upping the shock value by 3.
When Tobias gets up, his hair all askew, and walks across the room toward the camera, wow. All I can see is his hair. And I know that's... You probably don't believe me. There was more of Tobias than just his hair, but he just saunters. He has no problem as an actor, not problem, but you know, he doesn't seem shy at all, is what I'm saying.
I mean, well, I know what they're paying him for.
He's embodying the character. I'll say that. So he starts to get dressed, and Jamie tells him he owes him a debt, which would be the good death that he promised. And then as he's continues to get dressed and put his hair back, and he goes out to see what this ruckus is, what the racket is, Jamie says, please. That's pretty heartbreaking right there. He's like, he's lost the love of his life, he's lost all of his family, he's lost everyone, and he did this, he made the last promise to save his wife. And all he can hope for now is release. And at least at this point, Tobias seems unwilling.
Oh, no, he didn't seem unwilling at
BJR
all.
BJR seemed unwilling to
I don't think he was unwilling. No, he was about to give it to him. I thought that's exactly what he was doing when he heard the skirmish out in the hallway. I think if it weren't for those darn cows, Jamie would have gotten what he asked for.
I don't think he would have, in the end, refused to do it. I don't think he was ready to do it.
He looked like he was ready to do it. He got his knife and he was walking over.
I understand that, but that's also a way to taunt someone that you've just broken. All they want is release from their pain and their humiliation, and to deny them that is even more sadistic. So who knows? We won't know because it didn't end that way, but I can see both ways. In the end, I think he would have done it, but right then, I don't think he was going to. There's a noise, as you said, that he hears, and he's going to investigate it, and I love how the pipes start up, all upbeat when the cattle move through the passage, and the shot of BJR as he's under the door, you know, run over, appears to be dead, if not at least very majorly hurt.
Well, all I can say is it looked like after the door hit him, all the cows went around him.
That's true. They didn't go on top. Yeah.
So
the rescue party find Jamie and they rescue him. I wrote, love the coos.
Yeah, what I said was Highland cows, the most underrated of superheroes.
Love Claire fidgeting in the road and anxious as she waits to see if Jamie's alive. That was... I don't know. I liked her kind of like, you know, the waiting husband, but the waiting wife. I wouldn't say cute because it's very sad what happened and why she's waiting, but very human, very touching that she's like nervous and hopeful. When the cart gets there and she's in the cart and she's bending over him, this is the first hint of their theme in this episode. The thing, and then they realize that he is surrounded by the stench of lavender, and...
But before that, can we discuss the fact that Murtaugh is not the largest man in the group, yet he is always the one carrying the large person?
He's just, yeah, he must be very strong.
Now, granted, he was the only one with Claire when she collapsed the first time, when she was puking outside of Wentworth, and he carried her at that point. And then, when he pitched him out of the cell... He carried him. Now, Rupert was clearly the largest of the crew that was there. So I don't know if it was a Fraser thing, where he was just like, no one's going to carry my kinsman but me.
Oh, I thought it was a Fraser thing, like, of inhuman strength.
Well, no, but that's a given. But no, I don't know if it was a pride thing that made him be like, I'm carrying my kinsman, none of you can touch him, or what exactly. But I did think it was weird that he was not the largest man of that group, and he was the one who was carrying him. With no assistance, mind you, from anyone else.
So back to the lavender. In the book, the reason lavender has the same effect, meaning when the time they get to the Abbey, the smell of it makes Jamie sick. That part isn't different. The difference is, as my friend Kate so eloquently, or someone, if I'm misquoting you, please let us know, someone so eloquently put it on Twitter this evening, in the book, it wasn't used as lube. Or anything, or healing, or anything like that. In the book, it was simply, I don't know if it was, it was like crushed lavender that his handkerchiefs were stored in, or well, what, it was, but it was like it was his scent.
It was a scent that was attributed to him.
Yeah, like whether his soap or right. his something.
It could have been all of those things. It was it a scent matter. He
exactly.
favored.
It was exactly, a scent that he liked, a scent that was associated with him. Whereas in the series, we don't have smell-o-vision, we can't know what he smells like. He may smell like it, but we don't ever hear about
it. But it's never been mentioned prior to this episode.
That's what I said. We never hear about it. So, okay, that's the first thing, we don't hear about it. The second thing is, it's used a bit. Like, when he first uses it,
he comes in later. He uses it, like, to rouse him, like, to wake him. Like an ammonia salt. Like, when he was starting to pass out, he's like, rattling all over him. He's like, wake up. Which I think is funny because so many people use lavender for calming. Though maybe, you know, it's more of a hallucinogenic.
Well, I think so when they're in the back of that cart and Claire is bending over him trying to, you know, assess his wounds, Jamie kind of is shocked awake or sees her and tries to choke her. Actually is seeing Randall, but chokes her, and the other men, or Murata, have to kind of disentangle them. Then the next scene, we are at the Abbey, finally. And they arrive, and their theme is playing slowly, but also incompletely. We meet Father Anselm, who definitely seems a little bit older than I had pictured in my mind. I don't know what I pictured, but it just, I don't think he was that old in from whatever image I'd had from the books.
But I wonder, though, if they were just combining a bunch of the Abbey characters together into one and kind of using that one character to represent many characters.
Oh, sure, because the time, they just don't have time anyway. When Claire is trying to help Jamie and set his hand, at least at first, he's not having any of it. He's like, I can't look at you right now. I don't want you here. I don't want this. And pretty soon, since there is nothing there, we learn, or you recognize if you've read the books, that the hand setting is happening at the Abbey, or will happen, and not at Macarena's. I think for the sake of time, this was a good change, and of course it does not take away from the storyline. Were you understanding of them leaving out Macarena's, or did it really matter to you?
I've almost ceased caring about what they leave out. Just because I'm trying to not...
You can't worry about it.
Yeah, I can't worry about it, and, you know, we say all the time, we understand it's a totally different animal, and I think that to truly understand that, you have to let it go. And I think I've reached the point where I've pretty much let it go.
Actually, similarly to what you said about having multiple characters wrapped up in the one figure of Father Anselm, there's a lot of stuff that happens, you know, with someone else brought it up. We have it in the feedback, I think. There's a lot of stuff that happens. Not just are we not going to France, which I understand. That's long gone. But you have the escape, right? You have Macarena's, where some of the bone setting, hand setting happens. You have them escaping. This I totally forgot about. Them escaping on the horse with, and her having to kill that soldier. All of that. So it's just so much of that is, there's just not time. And it doesn't change the storyline. But yeah, I think just like there may be a number of characters, Abbey characters, kind of rolled into Father Anselm, there might be a number of other things kind of rolled into this, I don't know, hand-setting scene. We don't need Macbeth. We don't need them escaping and her killing a soldier. It's effective, but yeah, it's the books, and it's a different animal. It's just interesting how much was kind of skipped over. Not in a bad way, because we don't really need it, but and it definitely gets in the way of time, and that's their biggest enemy right now is time. When Jamie and Claire are talking, and she is asking him what happened in that room, in that cell, and he says, too much and not enough. And every time I've seen the episode, and every time I've listened to that, man, that, it's just, it gets me every time he says that. His delivery is just amazing. And then we're taken through Jamie's mind back to Wentworth just after Claire's escorted out. So the episode starts at the very end of Wentworth, and now we're taken to the very beginning, just after Claire is thrown down that hole. BJR removes the nail from Jamie's hand, and then Jamie is spitting up blood and falling all over the floor, and the way Randall brings the bucket of water over to him in an almost caring manner, there's something here that is almost worse than the abuse. It's like he's showing it that he cares in some way. It's not just, you know, in some weird, sick, twisted way, I'm going to do this to you, I'm going to do that to you, I'm going to make you wish you were dead, or whatever. This is almost more cruel than just being cruel to someone. You are kind of being nice, and not that Jamie believes him, but it still has to, if you're in all this pain, you want to, your soul, your mind wants to grab on to something that is kindness or...
No, but I think the real issue, though, is more to the fact that it wasn't just physical physical torture. And if it was just physical torture, Jamie could have blocked it out.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's what he did before when he was flogged.
Mm-hmm.
But this became a mental torture. And I think that is something that's a lot harder to move past than just the physicality of it. But he also, BJR said, the worst is over now, you'll see. Like,
no. Yeah, right. Not so much.
Not so much. And then I also, when he brought the bucket over and was holding him, and I've seen this online too, but I thought of it when I was actually watching the episode, that this was the first mention of, like, that Christ allegory.
Mm-hmm.
When he was holding him in the same manner of Michelangelo's Pietà. That statue is of Mary holding Christ.
Mm-hmm.
Mary the mother, not Mary Magdalene.
Not Black Jack the father.
No. And it was Mary holding the dead body of Christ. And so, and he was holding him pretty much in the mirror image of that. Not the right way, but of, like, if we were looking in a mirror, it was kind of like the backwards way. And then he appeared to baptize him.
Yeah, with the water.
With the water.
He did the baptizing first, with what appeared to be baptizing first. And he brought the water over, and he just, like, took it and, like, you know, made... And I watched it a few times. It didn't look like he was making
it was
across.
Just, like, once across,
it was
like,
a touching him. But, well, yeah, it wasn't just, a boop. It was, like, he definitely moved his hand across his forehead with it. And the way he turns Jamie's head to meet his own mouth to kiss him, his hands are so graceful. I think he has graceful hands anyway, but the way he moved it, like, you know, when they tell, at least when we were young, you know, tell little girls to drink a glass of, a cup of tea and put your pinky finger out and, you know, turn it up so it's dainty. It wasn't quite that dainty, but he had, like, one of his fingers pointing out like he was drinking tea. He was just so, it was so graceful. And then when he gets after Jamie for not kissing him back and says, I know you can do better, he touches Jamie's nose with the tip of his forefinger, the tip of his right forefinger. And that's something you do to a child, either maybe not in mock admonishment or in playfulness, or even a loved one. I'm like, this is all, I wouldn't say this is his seduction of him yet, but it's that playfulness that is,
I mean, it's a cat and mouse game.
Yeah.
Like, from beginning to end, it's like, it's positioning him, it's pushing Jamie into these positions that he can force him back to do what he wants. And mentally breaking him was clearly his goal from the beginning.
I wrote, uh-oh, when BJR goes up the kilt.
Forget that. Let's not even go that far yet. I got mad when he changed the rules. Because he's like, I'm not, you can do whatever you want to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I won't fight you. Just get her out of here.
Mm-hmm.
And then the minute she's gone, he's like, well, you have to do more than that.
Yeah.
That's not what we agreed. I can bring her back anytime.
That was new.
And that made me mad. And then he told me he was kissing like a corpse. I was like, ew.
How would you know this?
I know, exactly. And then he said, I wondered if he was directed to lick Jamie's closed mouth or if that was just Tobias.
I must have.
When he stuck his tongue out, like, right before he, like, kissed him again. And I was like, that was right up there with putting his thumb in Jenny's mouth. I'm like, that is another, like, move that makes me just kind of, like, skeeve a little bit.
Oh, was that when he... Yeah. No, when he sat him up and then put him in the chair and was doing the whole up-the-kilt thing.
Even... But I'm still not even there yet.
Oh.
Still not even there yet.
We had a long pause.
We had our second Christ comment of the episode where he says, your plan to submit, like, unlike Christ on the cross,
was a second, like, Christ representation on that episode.
Licks Jamie's closed mouth. He makes a second.
He did. It's gross.
He made a comment.
Hearing it makes it weird.
I know. And, you know, I guess if it was willing participants, it wouldn't be quite so gross. But because it's, like, somebody who clearly does not want to kiss him, like, I'm just imagining being forced to make out with somebody I'm not wanting to make out with and them, like, licking my closed mouth. It's just gross. That just skeeves me out.
Yeah.
It's not a dude-on-dude thing. It's not. It has nothing to do with that. It has to do with a willing versus unwilling for me. But after that, he makes his second Christ comment of the episode, which was something about him planning to submit like Christ on the cross. Each progressive scene between Jamie and BJR, I kept saying to myself, well, that just got more uncomfortable to watch. And I think that happened as the episode went on. It was like every time they came back, it was like they had to do one more thing that was one more level worse than the last thing we saw.
Yeah. So when he puts him on the chair and he goes up the kilt, that was uncomfortable. I mean, everything was uncomfortable, but that was uncomfortable to watch. Am I correct in saying that we did not? I mean, maybe if you had like a huge blow-up screen and you turned the brightness on, you might have caught a hint of something. But we did not see Sam's bits this episode at all.
No, we've never seen Sam's bits.
No, we haven't seen it up until now. And I don't believe we saw it in this episode. I read in an article that he said about 116 that...
I mean, he was pretty much naked almost the entire
episode. Oh, he was definitely naked. But he did an interview. There was an article talking about... He's like, not that he didn't want to do nudity. He didn't want to do it until or unless it was needed, basically. But the way it came out... So technically, you could still say he did nudity in this episode. We just didn't see every single part, and that's fine. But the interview / article that I read made it appear that he definitely did the frontal or the nudity in this episode. And I'm like, did I miss something?
Because they could have cut it out. I mean, but it seemed like most of the time he was tastefully turned away.
Absolutely. Or there was shadows.
Yeah. His hand was in the way.
So, yeah. I mean, we saw his backside, but yeah. And then probably one of the many times it was uncomfortable to watch something, when BJR bends down and fellates Jamie.
Is that the real term?
Yeah, it didn't get an underline in spell check, so I'm guessing it right. What, fellates? I mean, what am I supposed to say?
Fajita? Oh, my, that sounds like a drink I don't want. Fellates.
So... when he does that, I'm like, really? I mean, that was literally, well, not in our face, but literally in your face. I mean,
it was in his face.
Well, willingly, yeah, no. And then Jamie says, take your pleasure and be done with it, and spits in his face. BJR.
I watched that scene with a little bit of awe, because I am not capable of spitting like that at all, actually. I have no skill in spitting. So when I saw that scene, I was like, if I was in a scene like this, I would need a stunt spitter. Because I am not capable.
A lot of time, haven't you read or heard, there was something I saw, I don't know if it was in a soap opera, about a soap opera show. There was some scene in some movie or some show where someone had to spit on someone, and they had to do like multiple takes. And what they did to get the consistency, and because if you do it so many times, you're going to lose your saliva, right? Yeah, you can't make it that much, produce so much. They would put Vaseline, like a little chunk of Vaseline in their mouth, which lubricates you and also comes out, and it looks like a wad of nasty.
Yeah, and can we just say that when he spit on Tobias's face, it literally just sat there.
So maybe it was
Vaseline. It didn't roll.
Maybe it was Vaseline.
I don't know what it was, but it was nasty. Spitting on people in their face always makes me go, ugh. Not that he didn't deserve it, but as each scene got progressively harder to watch, I just kept thinking of the fact that our father watches the show, and I'm thinking that he may have skipped this one. Like, he may have gotten to a certain point and said, I'll check back in next season. Or he may have gotten to the point and said, I'm done with the show. So,
He won't be done. We can get him to read more, but he may not have finished the episode.
I wasn't even watching it with him, and I got a little bit uncomfortable just thinking about it.
So after he spits in his face, BJR is like, okay then, two can play this game. And he bends him over the table and rapes him.
After he spits in his, it was like spit for a spit.
No, spit and then like smacks his ass.
It's like a straight up loogie spit though. Like he like worked that
I mean,
spit.
He did work it. He was like
I know. Gross.
Back at the Abbey, okay, I just realized that sounded like a seal. Oh,
but you know what he said? He said when he was kneeling in front of Jamie.
Yeah.
He said, don't play the worm.
That was...
And that was like... That took me a second. To me, I was thinking, is that a reference to Jamie being flaccid?
Or is that a reference to Game of Thrones?
Thank you. Grey Worm. That's exactly what I thought. I was like, is it a reference to Grey Worm from Game of Thrones?
Goodness. Because if so, well played.
Exactly.
Oh my goodness. A whole new mind-boggling. So then back at the Abbey, Claire has been trying to get him to take laudanum to seduce him. To sedate him.
Wait.
Yeah.
Before we go on. I love BJR's complete awareness of the fact that he's a villain. And he just gives himself over to it 100%. Like, he just...
You mean Tobias?
No. Blackjack. His awareness of himself as a character. His awareness...
talking about how he cannot control or can't control the
darkness. Yeah, he's like, you think I can't control this? You think I don't know? You think I can't... I'm not... I'm less than that. And then when he is raping Jamie the first time of the episode... And he's telling him to scream. Like, the sound of Tobias's voice telling Jamie to scream, like, I can't get away from it. I hear it in my head, like, on a repeat. It's creepy. So, well done, Tobias. But, yeah, you creeped me out.
Okay, are we going to the Abbey?
Let me see. Yes, go ahead.
So, back at the Abbey, Claire has been trying to convince Jamie to take laudanum so that she can set his hand. Finally, he takes it. This may seem a little odd.
He not only took it, he like downed the bottle like that. He was trying to
take it away from him.
He was like hoping he was going to have enough in that little bottle to take him off.
This is one of those things that we haven't gotten a ton of it. I know more scenes like this come in future books, but I love seeing Claire get her nurse skills on. And, yeah, it was graphic, but I loved seeing the bone setting and the surgery. But I like observing that kind of thing. So maybe I'm not the average person who likes to watch that, but I liked it. What did you think about watching the surgery?
Is it kind of tried gross? Not to. Oh, I don't really like watching surgeries.
The bone was quite it was graphic.
Gross. That was gross. But, it seemed like, I know she's in her voiceover, she talked about how some of the things were difficult to do, but it didn't seem like it, the way she was just matter-of-factly pushing through each digit and each correction. It just seemed like she had her plan, she made it happen. Didn't seem like it was that much of a struggle.
And yet, when she's done and she walks into the hallway, she vomits, and she says, just as Jamie had said, that he could bear anything except for her pain, she says she knew what he meant. The next scene, she's back in her dress, and Claire is in the chapel, and Father Anselm comes in, and she's saying, he says, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to disturb you, and she's like, oh, no, I was just in here alone, and he says,
but
were you indeed alone? I'm so glad they kept that line, or the spirit of that line.
Because, I mean, that was a morph of a bunch of different scenes that happened in the books.
Yeah.
Because she, would wander down to the chapel. In the book, she wandered down to the chapel and hung out with Father Anselm.
A few times.
As he, what do they call it? He was keeping the holy, whatever.
It was
keeping it company. Like, somebody was with it all the time.
Yes.
Like, it was the communion or
perpetual adoration.
Thank you. So there was somebody always in the chapel at all times
with the Eucharist.
With the Eucharist. So it was the mention of that and how, the one night he like leaves her in there by herself for a while, and he came back and she was like, she didn't realize he was gone. And he was like, yeah, I left. And she was like, it's funny, I didn't feel like I was alone the whole time. So I thought that was a nice nod to the books in there.
I like the scene. I'm glad they kept her confession. I'm glad they kept it, but it just, because they kept, and I understand, again, for reasons of time and space, but because they kept so little of the Abbey, right, what truly, because it was a lot, he did his healing there.
He convalesced.
Because they did so little of the parts with her and the father, her and the brothers, and there is this confession scene, but it was all in one scene. I liked it. It was beautiful. I liked that she was able to tell everything. I don't want to say it seemed rushed, but there was so much that happens in the Abbey, in the book, that to get, although they're at the Abbey, to get this one scene is nice. But I'm not saying I would rather have not had it. I'm glad we have it. But it's hard to not want more. And I don't just mean that as a book reader, like, oh, I want all this stuff. No, I just mean it didn't seem out of place, but it seemed almost incomplete because they only had this one scene. Up until now, we don't even know that Claire's Catholic. She says she was nominally religious, but we never hear of her Catholicism. Jamie's we do. He never says Catholic, I don't think, but we know from his family, we know from the priest, all that kind. We can guess, and the Jacobites, a lot of them are. But in the book, it's not made a huge deal of, but we do know that Claire is Catholic.
Yeah, but she wasn't religious.
That doesn't matter. She was still Catholic.
But that's what she was getting at in this scene.
But if you're not Catholic, you can't go to confession. That's the point. And so he just assumes that she's Catholic. That's what I'm saying. So without having made that clear,
wouldn't that be accurate for the time period, though? Wasn't anyone going to confession? But during that time period, isn't that a healthy assumption that
Not an English person, no. Because of the Reformation and closing of a lot of the abbeys and...
But I also think that him giving her that opening, regardless of what her actual religious affiliation was as much kind of a let me lighten your spirits or lighten your load.
I don't disagree.
Then let me be your religious guide. You know, I think that it had many purposes.
It definitely did. But you don't do it to say, you don't offer that, or say offer that. You don't
know that. If I walked into a Catholic church tomorrow and I walked into the confessional booth, they'd hear me, whether or not they wouldn't be like, I'm sorry, I need your Catholic card. Can you prove to me that you're a Catholic so I can ask you for your confession? Because if not, then you need to take off.
No, because they don't ask that. That question's not asked. But there's a form of a confession, and if you don't know what the form is, they're going to know right away that you don't know what you're doing.
Right, but she didn't even do that form anyway.
That is true.
So it's irrelevant.
That is true. All I'm trying to say is I agree with you that it's different things at different levels. It's not just a, you know, purely religious kind of thing. All I'm saying is we never hear of her religion. We know she's not religious, but we never hear of her religion. But to have it kind of come up now without having been mentioned, even though it was very, very nominal, it was just a little bit of a shock, and it just seemed one thing mentioned in episode one or two, or even at the wedding, would have taken care of all of it. That's all. In a line. I'm not even talking about a scene.
I don't think it matters. I don't think it's that integral to the plot line that it's important that somebody made mention to the fact that she was or wasn't one particular religious affliction. Persuasion.
That's funny.
Because I think that, like I said, if I went into any church and it was a church that offered confession as a way to make you feel better about yourself or to help ease your mind of something, I would offer it to you whether or not you were of that religion or not. Well, here's what I can offer you
to help you feel better. Not the purpose of confession. It is a result of it.
They didn't even go to a real confession. They didn't go to a confessional.
But you don't have to. There's face
and
to
he,
face.
And technically, he's not even of the right persuasion to take a confession. He's a monk. Point is, confession is supposed to be an anonymous thing. It's supposed to be an anonymous thing where you don't see the person who's hearing the confession, you don't see the person who's giving the confession. So, I mean, there are a lot of little, like, rules as far as Catholic confessions are concerned that weren't followed in this episode. Am I going to worry about any of them? No.
But that's not even a rule. It is typical, at least today, that you go into a confessional, and it can be anonymous, but you can still do it face-to-face. That's not a rule. I'm just saying that's not a rule.
Well, then can we also point out the fact that he didn't hold a gun to her head and say, give me your confession. He said, would you like me to hear your confession?
Absolutely.
And by the fact that she didn't say, no, I'm not Catholic, shouldn't that have been enough to answer that question, whether or not she's Catholic?
I'm not talking about the question of whether or not she's Catholic. I'm saying the fact that he offered it, and she didn't say no. I think it's safe to assume. We know from the book she is Catholic. I don't think they changed that for the series. All I'm saying is, in the series, we have no idea that she is.
Right, but don't you think that's possibly irrelevant? Because he would have offered that to anyone who came to the Abbey as a source of absolution.
Well, we don't know what he would have offered, but it makes sense that he would offer it as he did to her. My point here is that this scene from the book that is much beloved, I think I'm very happy they kept it, but to have not mentioned her religion before, even though it's not important to her, you know, she's not religious, I just think that it would have been nice if they had mentioned it. Not done anything, not practiced anything, just mentioned it. Because while you're right, if she were Protestant, I think he probably still would have offered it. He could have maybe assumed she was Catholic because she was married to a Catholic. Who knows? But the scene, I think we can both say we're glad it's there. It just happens all of a sudden. To me, it seems it happened all of a sudden. Like something else that happened all of a sudden, kind of in this episode later on.
Well, I want to say that Claire must have been a little disappointed in Father Anselm's response to her telling him that he was in the future, because he really didn't do much. He was just like, go on. And then she proceeded to give the best 2-minute description of the first half of the Outlander novel that I've ever heard.
The first half? Or pretty much?
Well, the first 2/3 then.
There you go.
The first 2/3 of the novel. Like, literally, it was like, I was like, wow, I've had a lot of people ask me to tell them what the books are about, and I've not been that succinct.
Just play them episode 116.
Clearly, I need to just, just play them that one the segment. Snippet. Okay, this is from Claire's point of view, what happens in the book. And she, like, literally gives, like, the best 2-minute synopsis.
It was... Okay, so again, not comparing for purposes of saying what's better or what's worse, but if you're going to include this confession, right, you kind of alluded to it already. There's so much that happens in this scene in the book, I think we lose some of it here. We don't have his wonderful responses. We get the fact that he thinks it's a miracle and it's wonderful and it's marvelous because we get it that he believes her. But in the book, it's like the joy of a child. It's marvelous.
Like I said, like because they've combined so many of the different Abby characters together, it might have been out of character for the character they created to have him be like boyishly giddy about the idea of time travel. But it was also when she did come in and give the confession in the books, it was more that she was looking for someone to tell her that she wasn't a bigamist. And that wasn't anything that came into the play into the scene, which I was okay with.
I'm okay with anything. All I'm saying, it was interesting. If you're going to go to the trouble of having this scene, it's interesting that while she definitely, you know, her load lightens from this, she benefits from it. That whole part of I'm a bigamist, I agree with you. It's interesting that that part wasn't... She mentions her husband's in 2 times, but it was interesting that more weight, wasn't given to her feeling so guilty about, being a bigamist or not. And something else that was from the book that was interesting, when they have this conversation, his response, he gives some kind of analogy about being being shipwrecked. Remember how she's on a ship and the ship crashes, the ship shipwrecks, and she's going to shore, and all she has with her is her knife, or is a knife, and she has to make her own way now among new people, among a new place. And I don't remember exactly what the analogy of the knife was, but it was just because you have that, maybe that was the knowledge. Just because you have something doesn't mean that you have to use it, but if you need to use it, you can. It can be a weapon, but it doesn't mean it has to be a weapon. You can also use a knife to kill food and for sustenance. So I think that would have been great or neat if they had brought that in a little bit. But again, it's such a short scene, and in the book, I think it goes over a number of pages. So the decisions they made for the episode, they worked. It just seemed very abrupt, that's all. So Jamie's not eating his oatmeal, his pottage. And he has a fever. So that's not very good. I think they're talking and Wee Willie is saying something along the lines of, he reminds me of my uncle. Didn't he say his uncle?
Yeah.
How his uncle got basically lost his arm and he was depressed and then refused to eat and starved himself to death. And Murta kind of stomps off and he's like, I didn't mean to compare him to Jamie to my uncle, but... I like Willie. He was trying to help. He was trying to... I mean, obviously, he didn't make the situation worse, but he compared the situation, which it totally could have been, to something where the same situation actually did meet the worst possible end. And then comes probably one of the most beautiful scenes in this episode, if not in a number of episodes, and that is the completely... Gaelic scene. That sounds weird. The scene completely in Gaelic between Murta and Jamie. And I still can't wait to read. I have not read Mandy's update yet, her of all the Gaelic.
Hers isn't finished, so.
Oh, good.
What I will say about this scene was that I thought it was such a brilliant performance by both Duncan Lacroix and Sam Heughan that I don't think the subtitles were needed. I thought that if you were able to follow the emotion of the scene and able to understand, if not word for word, what they were saying, you understood the meaning behind their phrases that they gave. And while I will still look forward to reading a translation of what the actual words were, just to kind of see how close I was and how I felt about the scene, I think they made the right choice by not subtitling it.
Well, not subtitling it throughout the whole series.
Yeah, but I was reading online, Ron Moore himself had said it, that he could have subtitled it, given the fact that this was the only time Gaelic was used that wasn't in Claire's presence. Mm-hmm. So it could have been reasonable to have the subtitles in this, but I think they were like, you know what, we haven't done it yet, let's not do it now. But I, like I said, I don't think he was needed. I thought it was a really powerful scene the way that it was.
And then we are transported back to Wentworth. Jamie is writhing on the ground in pain, blood smeared between his thighs and buttocks. He starts to see BJR as Claire. He's in pain. He's probably, I won't say starving, but he's probably dehydrated, and he's in shock and all of this, and he's tired. And he starts to hallucinate a little bit with a lot of images kind of probably running together. BJR wants to unlock Claire's power over him, and he begins to invoke her. Jamie on the ground is crying, and did you not bawl almost when he said, crying, there's no more Claire?
No, I did not.
That's because you're a robot,
That's
as you say.
Because I'm a robot.
That was awful. I mean, he knows she's gone because he's the one who said, you know, get her out of here. I'll do whatever you want to do. Get her safe. But he knows, he believes he can last through whatever BJR has planned because he knows she's safe and it's like, it doesn't matter anyway. I'm going to be dead one way or the other. At least she's out. But as you said, when BJR kind of changes the rules, like, look, dude, I can bring her back. When he says, when he's crying, and it's like, because this keeps going on, and he's like not getting any relief or release from,
well,
you know.
He got a lot of release.
Well, but not in the way he wanted it. And when he says there's no more Claire, it's like a child. It just, it's so sad, so sad. Sam did an amazing, this is such his episode. And then BJR goes to brand Jamie, but he makes him do it himself. And did you notice how he's, before he hands over the brand, he is, or as he's holding Jamie's hand around it, he takes his finger with his hand and he kind of rubs a spot just above his heart. Like he wants it there, right?
Well, he was telling him that's where he wanted him to
put
it.
Yeah, and then Sam's like, I'll do it. Or sorry, Jamie. And he takes it and he does it to his side.
But I don't know, and I had questions about that because I couldn't tell if that was his like last minute show of defiance by not putting it there or if he started to fall and that's, because it almost looked like he started to fall and that's where he could catch himself. So I don't know. I couldn't quite tell the intention and the intended intention of that moment. It could have gone either way for me.
I don't think I've seen it as anything other than a show of defiance. But again, if you're defying someone, you're still getting hurt. So, and then we're back at the Abbey. The group discusses where Jamie and Claire will go next. And we learn that the plan is to go to France to see their cousin Jared.
Well, they didn't say Jared. They just said...
a cousin.
Fraser cousin.
Yeah. Who is Jared?
Oh, we know that, but non-book readers don't know that. So stop spoiling.
That's not a spoiler. It's just a name. But he was cast today, so... Jamie wants to end his life. He asks... Wee Willie's in there, and he asks him
Poor
to give
Willie.
Him his knife.
That's like literally like the worst nickname.
Oh, well, yeah. He asks Willie for his wife.
His what?
His wife. And Willie refuses. He tells Myrta.
No, he doesn't. He tells Claire, and then Claire goes to Myrta and was like...
So Willie refuses. He's not going to allow or help him kill himself. Then we're in a scene with... in the hallway, Myrta tells Claire that they've got passage to France. It was expensive, but they'll be safe. And this is where... Claire says that Willie told her that Jamie asked him to kill him. Now, I don't know that Jamie asked him to kill him. Jamie wanted his knife, but I'm sure he would have been happy with Willie doing it, or if he had his knife, he would have done it himself. Doesn't really matter. The end effect is the same, but I'm not sure that he was asking Willie to do it, but he would have been part
he
of it.
He definitely wanted the knife. That's exactly. all that we can...
Exactly. That's what I'm saying. He says, I'm sorry, truly sorry. I'd never do anything to hurt our lad. And...
However, if I saw him exactly. wasting away, I would take care of it.
Yes. And Claire's response is to faint in his arms. And she comes to the priest or the brother is saying, you know, he's healing, Jamie's healing, but there's some, his soul is still in darkness and he's got to get some help or it's going to destroy him, basically. Someone has to step into the darkness, he says, with Jamie to save him. And then we see Claire preparing.
We're like, cue Claire stepping into the darkness.
Yeah. Now, this is where, again, not saying, it doesn't make it bad, but it's another choice, like, okay, like with the confession thing. If you're going to do it, I'm glad you kept it, but it just seemed almost incomplete or odd because it was out of the blue and it didn't... Because there was so much that was left out, it just didn't seem... It kind of stuck out. Like that, I'm glad they kept the prep scene. I'm glad they kept their like, a mini version of what the book had as far as them, you know, tumbling and tussling each other. They wrestle. When she goes in there to confront him, it starts out exactly like I would have expected, right? With, you know, she's like, no, pay attention, and then she, like... jumps on him and he jumps on her and then she slaps him and then he drops, you know, shoves her down. That was perfect. I loved it. It just seemed so quick and it was not the, what do you call it? Like the drag out, kick him, bite him, you know, hold him by the scruff of their neck. And it was not what was in the book. I know it's not the book, but it started that way. With, you know, Ruff, her saying, I have left you alone too long. I am going to take you out of this. We're going to make this happen, basically. And he responded exactly as he, you know, we were expecting him to. But then as soon as he got her on the ground, I don't want to be less than a husband to you. I want to be the whole thing I was before. And then he shows her the brand. And it seemed like at first that was something that upset him, that he was not going to tell her because of the brand. And then, of course, we get the other scene. But it also seemed weird that when she was going over his body for his wounds, wouldn't she have seen the brand?
I thought about that is that perhaps until it healed a little bit, she couldn't see the initials in it. So maybe in the beginning it was just a big, angry red welt.
Red mark.
And it probably didn't have any kind of definition in it until it started to heal. Was what I thought about that. But that was pretty gnarly. But I would like to give a major shout out to Terry Dresbach for designing, like, the hottest hospital gown I've ever seen.
I mean, like, the strips that hit everything.
It did, and it allowed his, like, muscular arms to be on full display. And then it was
thighs,
like,
and his thighs.
It was beautiful. Well done. Well done, Terry Dresbach.
And then the last thing we hear or learn before we go back again, I think for the final time to Wentworth, is that Jamie says that BJR made love to him. And then we go... So back at Wentworth, BJR applying lavender to Jamie's burn. And this is where, okay, so the first time we see it, it's because Claire had said it's got healing properties. So, okay, I can see it as him. Again, that weird, as you say, cat and mouse, where he's victim.
He's playing with his food.
He's his victim, but he's also trying to make his victim, you know, I guess gain his trust. I wouldn't say gain his trust, but... be nice to him or whatever. It's that weird, sick dichotomy. And he says that as he's putting, not lotion, as he's putting the lavender oil on him, he says, these are Claire's hands. And I wrote, this point is where the seduction starts. Before, it was just kind of like, you know, being weird, being nice, Christ figure types or Christ whatever type stuff. This is where the seduction happens, I believe, when he starts to invoke Claire.
And that's where I thought things got super creepy.
Very. He kisses him, and Jamie reaches up and kisses him back.
Tries to. His mangled, bleeding hand.
Exactly. And when he's like, you can tell him trying to like to sit up. And then I didn't know what I think I may have saw. And then I wrote, did he, meaning BJR, did he just drop oil on his groin?
Yes, not on BJR's groin,
no.
But on Jamie's
groin.
Well,
he started on Jamie's groin. Then he says, and then he drops the oil on his groin, and then he goes to town a little bit. But then he stops. Or does Jamie go to town on himself?
Well, I think it was a group effort.
Because then BJR says, wait for me.
I think he put Jamie's hand down there.
Okay.
And Jamie started taking care of his own stuff. And then he said, wait for me.
Exactly. So then I wrote, dang it, this oil is everywhere. And I can barely watch this. Because then, I don't know if he pours it again, but he definitely already has some on his hand. He doesn't necessarily need it. But then BJR goes to town on himself with the oil. I'm like, this oil, as I said on Twitter, this episode is brought to you by some kind of lavender oil because it's everywhere. Okay, so when BJR, when he then climbs, as he climbs behind him on the bed or before he does, I think he says, wait for me, and that's when he gets himself ready or whatever, and then he goes behind him, right? Mm. When BJR takes his wig hair down, as opposed to what hair, I don't know, the hair of his wig. He's like back in a queue, right? When he brings it down to like fall around his face, I may have shaken. I'm sorry. That was hot.
You're gross.
I'm not gross.
You have issues. That whole thing bothered me, and you're like salivating.
What he did was disgusting. The scene was disgusting and disturbing. What I'm saying is, I have said from day one that I like Tobias in a wig. And I said from day one, I wish he would take his wig hair down. All I'm saying is, I appreciate the way he looks when he took it. Not the stuff he did and messing with his face and talking about Claire. That was gross. I'm talking about him with the hair down. He just looked nice with the hair down. That's all I'm going to say.
Gross.
Not gross.
No, and he shook it out like it was a wig. Like
That's like true. You can tell Tobias has never...
Never had long hair.
Or at least not in a long time.
He shook his hair out like he was afraid it was going to come flying off of his head.
It was very gentle, yes. So I wrote, just in case you didn't hear me the first time, I don't find what he did to Jamie nice. But the hair, only the hair, and not the hair thing he did with Jamie, but just him letting his hair down. His wig down is amazing. That's all I mean. So, which is what made me feel so conflicted about this scene. Not what he does, but how he looks. It's not difficult for me to reconcile. First of all, he's acting. Second of all, it's a wig. Third of all, it's a disgusting scene. But just, I appreciate the way he looks, and that's why it's weird. But then when he starts to rub his hair, his wig hair, over Jamie's face, shoulder, etc., further invocation of Claire, the hair bit is even more disturbing.
No, and I didn't think about it until he took his hair down that his hair is roughly the same length as Claire's.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, I don't know. I just get grossed out when people, like, grab their hair and, like,
I know,
poke it in their faces.
You.
And I'm like, blah.
He brings up his... Jamie brings up his injured hand to caress BJR's hair. All of a sudden, Jamie groans in pain or not pain. It's like I missed it because the like 5 seconds later, BJR is going to town on the back door. Did I miss him? Like, did he like enter him? I mean, I missed something. He was behind him.
You didn't miss it if you were paying attention. All you had to look was at Jamie's face. It was very clear what happened and when it happened.
Jamie, okay, the hair thing. Jamie reaches up with his injured hand, and at that time, he groans in pain or not pain is what I write. Is that groan what you mean?
Probably.
Because I didn't notice it in his face.
I'm not comfortable continuing to talk about this. I stopped taking notes because I didn't want to.
Okay.
So I don't need to get any more detailed about the specifics of what happens in this scene than you've already gone.
That's fine. Like I said, I was just shocked that I knew he was there. And I knew at one point what was going on. I didn't know when it started.
Your fascination on that is creeping me out right now.
I'm not fascinated. I was surprised I missed it. So from the look... Okay, never mind.
Jamie didn't miss it.
Then I won't say that. When he says... Okay, first of all, in any context, whether it's this or something else, but it's usually kind of like this, not in a man-on-man thing, but... Or, sorry, a rape thing, but in a, I guess, sexual thing. Any time there's like a say my name line, that is just disturbing. It's disturbing.
That's right up there with guys wanting you to call him daddy.
Oh, Lord. Okay.
You know what I mean?
That's enough.
It's like, it's just skeevy. And it is clearly skeevy. Also because he didn't want to be called his own name. He wanted to be called Claire.
And then when Jamie says Claire, BJR knows he's broken him. And the dissonance, if you listen to the music, comes right back in. Oy vey. Jamie goes along with it and encourages it. He can't stand himself, and he breaks. So he's actually not verbally encouraging it, but he's definitely partaking at this point. And then when that is done, and Jamie is crying, so sad, because he knows he has been broken. On Facebook, we had a comment from Tiffany Turner, and she said, "I read the books. It was hard to watch. So sad seeing Jamie broken. I wish we had another episode just dealing with the Abbey, but all in all, it was a stunning episode. Kudos to Sam and Tobias for brilliant performances."
But it was the final statement that that BGR made, where he was like, "How could she ever forgive you?" It was like him. It was the final nail in that mental breakdown.
The final, like, screw. For, pardon the pun. Like, that turning in the back of the knife. I mean, it's bad enough that I've broken you, but now, even though you're going to die in the morning, or I'm going to kill you, however you end up dying, doesn't matter, I got to get one more last jab in there. And then we're back to the Abbey. Jamie telling Claire what had happened, and he says he couldn't help himself. It felt so good not to be in pain. I wrote, "This scene is beautiful, but it does seem that they don't struggle as long as they should or may have." What did you think about that? Not his admission, but when she prepares and she goes in there, they have their wee struggle, and then he says what happens in the room. That part to me was awesome. But their struggle, I mean, it worked. It just seemed short.
I think it had to be. I mean, the scene in the book went on for an entire evening.
Yeah.
No one was going to be satisfied with what they brought to the screen. So I think the fact that it was like they did an homage to the scene in the book,
yeah,
but they had to move it forward they had to condense everything into scenes that were conducive to getting to where they needed to be at the end. And that means that they have to cut some stuff, put some stuff together, and try to make the story that they're putting on the screen as to make as much sense as possible. And I think that in that regard, they did the best they could.
Oh, I think they did the best they could. Her convincing him, saying that they belong together, though, do you think that was enough? From where he was emotionally to not wanting to look at her, it just seemed that it turned around quickly. That's all.
Well,
few words from her.
I think once he realized that he was not going to be able to save her by letting her go. Once he realized that by letting her go, she was going to die. Yeah.
She said she was
going to
die.
She's like, "If you're going, we're going together. And this is, you know, you're damning us both by making that decision." And I think he thought that if he pushed her away, she'd go back to her own time. But I think that once he realized that she was in it for the long haul, and if he was going to die in that room, she was dying in the room with him, he was like, "I need to think about this a little more."
Mm-hmm.
And maybe this isn't the only way.
Chris Valley also said, "I would love to have seen more of Claire and Jamie's absolution, but I realized that 1 hour wasn't nearly enough time to cover all the events we read in the book. Emotionally stunning performances, especially from Sam Heughan." Absolutely. This episode was probably owned by Sam.
I would not disagree.
I totally blubbered, like, the first two times. Not the second two times. When they had their hug, and his good arm comes up, finally, very slowly, to hold her. It took a little bit, but he did. And then, when they remove his brand, I thought, oh my gosh, the leather strap! It was used in the book in McGranick's house when she was setting his hand. They got the leather strap in there.
I just was grossed out by how
they dug it.
Sharp that knife was. And he just, like, literally, like, scooped it out of his skin like it was the top of a strawberry. Oh. Like, he just kind of, like, put it in there, just, like, scooped it around, and that was, like, that skeeved me out. But it was such a fun visual, but it was such an effective visual for him to throw it on the fire and just watch that brand burn. It was very symbolic, I thought.
Becky Kevin McKinney shared on Facebook, "I really missed McGranick and that whole scene. They did a good job, but sure strayed from the storyline." Well, I don't know that they strayed? I don't know that they strayed from the storyline, because again, the storyline is what happens to him, how they somehow come together, and they end up going to France. all of that happened. The storyline itself didn't happen. How they got there was, you know, definitely tightened up. So I missed the McRannick scene too, but you didn't need it. There was a way to handle it without going back there, because there was a whole bunch skipped, but again, didn't change the storyline. I wrote, the boat to France. Okay. The goodbye they had, it just seemed, it was very, I liked the comedy. I liked the lightness of it. We kind of needed it at the end of the episode. It was just weird that all of a sudden Angus would, like, cop a feel. And not try to kiss her. The kissing part was kind of, that made me laugh. But that just seemed out of left field. But it was entertaining.
I didn't think that was necessary. It was like, but I mean, it was, they've kind of been like, we've said earlier, like the Keystone Cops, like they're kind of like the foils for the show. Like you have your straight man and your comedic sidekicks, and they've kind of filled that purpose throughout. But I thought it was so much more effectively used, like earlier in the episode when Rupert says, you know, are you guys gonna have some tea here, or can we get this cart moving? You know, so it was like they are allowed to have those funny moments and say the funny lines without it taking away from the scene at hand. Whereas I thought that kind of took away from the scene a little bit.
Then there's reference to the King Across the Water. I thought that was nice. The music as they row out to the big boat is just lovely. And when they get to the big boat or we see them already on the boat, Jamie says to Claire, I thought I'd be the one to be puking my guts out over the side, ... I wrote, this is the first mention of his awful seasickness, so it seems like they may be keeping it. Jamie seems too happy. The change and healing is just so quick. Not too happy, like I don't want him not to be happy, but I guess if they had their get together back, and you know, once he realized.
No, I don't even think it's that way. But I mean, I know a lot of. I won't say I know a lot. I have known depressed people who put on a real good show to help other people feel more comfortable about things.
You think that's what
he's
doing?
And I'm not saying that that's 100% what he's doing, but I am saying that more than likely he's still working through a lot of stuff.
Oh, he's not
and
done.
And he is doing what he needs to do to make everyone else more comfortable.
This does not... Okay.
Because it's all kinds of awkward. All these people know that you've been ravaged by the sadist. And everyone knows your business. So...
Yeah, and... As we have said, not in the read-along, there's no reason to say it, because we've already gone past this. We're already in the early middle of book two. But I think in other episode discussions of the series, of the Star series, we have said that... As painful and as awful as it is, and number one, it's part of the story, but number two, it's this situation, what Jamie goes through, what both of them go through, because although she was not raped by a sadist, she journeys with Jamie in his recovery, to the most part that she can, but this experience stays with him and affects him. It makes him the Jamie we all know and love. Without giving any spoilers away, something like this, I guess you could guess, I hope you could guess, that this kind of thing ain't going away. That's all. You can get through it. I don't know that you get over it. But you definitely live with it, or he lives with it. And it is something that it always stays with him. That's not a spoiler. I mean, it's part of his makeup now. Claire says to him, I've been wondering how to tell you this. Marta assures me that once we're underway, you'll be too seasick to have a conversation. And then, okay, we've heard it twice now. That's proof enough. I wrote in all caps, they kept the seasickness. And the first time I watched, I'm like, wait, he's sitting there on the boat. He's not looking too queasy yet, but like realize that they're still anchored, or at least they're not moving yet. He's probably not feeling wonderfully, but they're not on the high seas yet. after she tells him that she's pregnant and asks, "Are you happy?" their theme music comes up very strong and very pure. And it's the music at the end of this episode is some of the most beautiful of the series. And then when Raya sang the theme song again, it was a different rendition or a different arrangement. Same song, but it was a different recording, I guess you could say. It was a little more poppy, or maybe R&B-ish, a little more soulful, but it was so lovely, and it didn't keep to a strict, you know, meter. It was a little more flowy. It was lovely. And then Jamie says back to her, "I'm very happy indeed, Sassenach. I love this ending. I thought it was so nice to give them such an upbeat ending. I mean, the book ends nicely too, but it was so nice that they had this. I think it was very, there's just something very romantic about a ship on the sea, about the sea in general. And then the music swells just like the sea does. It is huge, and it just turns and turns and turns. And as I said, some of my favorite music of Bears this for the series is in the end of this episode. And because they're on the ocean, and because the music is big, it makes me think about Voyager. I can't wait to see what Bear would do for that. So a little bit more of the Facebook feedback that some listeners, or maybe you haven't listened before, we welcome you if you're listening now, that some readers, at least of our Facebook page, wrote in response to our question of what did you think about the Outlander finale. Brandy Baldsell said, "Amazing, powerful, intense, sad, so sad. Sam was just wrenching. The scene between him and Claire, the breakthrough, had me sobbing. The scenes in the cell were brutal. Really hope to see cast and crew rewarded come Emmy time. Don't we all?" Maureen Young wrote, "I loved all the actors in episode 116. I really loved Murtagh Duncan. When he alone carries Jamie out of Wentworth, and when he and Jamie are speaking in Gaelic in the Abbey, you really see the strong bond between the two. Very touching. Love, Murtagh." Donna Gailkin says, "The hot spring scene where Claire says she has a surprise for Jamie, too, is missing. That line had me crying at the end of the book. Also the scene where she finally gets through to Jamie and they have the rough and tumble together wasn't completely shown in the episode." That is true, Donna, but as we know, they can't possibly show everything, but at least they got a little bit of the rough and tumble in there. They got the point across of that scene. Debbie Bishop writes, "Stars and Ron, the next time there is such an intense episode, please allow more time to expand on the scenes. Jamie's emotional torture was heart-wrenching and brutal. To balance this, we needed more scenes from the Abbey showing the depths Claire had to go to in order to save his soul. Having said that, this, I did love 116, and the acting was superb. Awards all around." Leslie Moreland shares, "Loved it. A book reader, emotionally charged. I cried, I laughed, I had joy at the ending. Superb acting by all. Shout out to Sam, Kate, and Tobias. I can't imagine anyone else's Jamie and Claire. Although, I agree with Donna, I wish they would have included the hot spring scene, but still fantastic." I think a lot of people would have loved to see that hot spring scene.
I think a lot of people would have, but I don't think it was integral to the plot line of the show, mostly because she never even made mention to the hot baths.
Until afterwards. Oh.
In the series.
Oh, you mean they didn't keep it, yeah.
Right, so if they didn't keep it there, it wasn't really necessary to follow it through.
And I don't think she didn't even tell him that she was pregnant until they were walking up back to the room.
It wasn't during the hot springs, it was after.
Angela Austin writes, "Book reader, shivers, tears, laughter, it was fantastic." Marianne Frank Koenig writes, "Relief, it is over. Here we go with Droughtlander again, great end." And like four hearts. Sue Richardson writes, "It was brill. Would have loved 90 minutes, but great. Especially Sam, Kate, Tobias, and Duncan." Lisa Burnett writes, "So intense. The little comedic bit at the end with Rupert and crew was amazing and needed after so much intensity. Some of the best acting I've seen in a long time." Heather McFarlane writes, "Was an epic finale, emotional roller coaster. I am a book fan and love the interpretation by Ron and co. Totally addictive TV, compelling as Diana's books. Can he wait for season 2? Love the podcasts. You can tell I am addicted, eh?" Allison Leslie Stuckey writes, "Great show. I knew what was coming, so I was prepared. It wasn't as bad as I thought it would be. I definitely think it was a necessary part of the show. People who are squeamish have the option not to watch. Better not to watch, especially if the comments are going to be negative. Outlander is an amazing story, every single word and description of it. When can we look forward to the next show?" Our show, tomorrow night, when you listen, you'll be hearing this. The next Outlander series episodes, from what we understand, definitely spring-ish 2016. Deborah Beckman writes, "The entire team did an amazing interpretation of Diana Gabaldon's mind-bending story for this episode. The essence is all there and exceptionally well done. Emmy now. I do want the Gaelic translation, please. Where can I find it?" Well, Deborah, that would be at mandysgreatscottblog.com. She will have that soon.
She has parts of it up now. I think she'll get the rest of the translation
by the end of the week, hopefully.
At a later date.
Sheila Cooper writes, 1 hour wasn't enough for the finale. They should have shot a 2-hour one. I read all the books, so I know what was coming, knew what was coming. It was hard to watch, but wonderfully done. I wish they would have spent more time showing how Claire brought back Jamie from the darkness. The cave scenes in the book were missed. Carol Edgar writes, great, powerful episode, except the ending was a little bit Hollywood. I can kind of see that. Emily Sonnenschein writes, amazing acting right there. That helped me to survive this episode. Most intensive horror I have ever watched. I felt for Jamie and for Claire. Glad we got a happy ending. I watched the show and started to read the books also. Have to go through this again since I'm at this point in the book also. I hope Sam and Tobias get an Emmy for this. I'm sure it wasn't easy to perform, but they acted brilliantly. Barb Delaney writes, I just started reading the book and watched every show more than once. To me, this is the only show worth watching on TV. Looking forward to watching season 2, 3, 4, etc. Any idea when season 2 will begin? And will they advertise here to let us know when? All the actors deserve awards. It was so real. Fantastic acting. Barb, from what we understand, it definitely is in 2016, probably in spring. Pamela Pearson Bradley writes, book reader and fan of the TV series, and especially the actors. I've read all of the books, and I understand the changes that had to be made. The final episode was heart-wrenching during the jail scenes. I had to close my eyes a couple of times. I was crying during the scene at the Abbey when Claire finally got through to Jamie. As others have said, I would like to have seen more expansion with the Abbey story, but it was still amazing acting and producing. Bravo to all. Jan Scroggins writes, it was so difficult to watch, and as a book reader, I knew what was coming, but if it was not with Sam Heughan, I would have turned it off. Diana Tolan writes, book reader, lover of both books and show. I managed not to cry, but I did feel nauseous several times. Many Emmy Awards earned. Lori Etnier writes, emotional roller coaster. Thank you for not going too far. Thank you for not showing everything from the book. The acting of Sam was amazing. Do you think that the book was more explicit or the show was more explicit? I mean, obviously the show, you're seeing it. But in the book, was more described, do you think?
The book was definitely more descriptive. I feel that it was. And maybe that's because it lived in my brain, and maybe my brain is a lot more twisted and sick than they were able to portray on the screen.
Wait, you were calling me twisted and sick earlier for all the stuff I was talking about Tobias's wig hair.
Yeah, it is. You are sick and twisted in ways that I am not sick and twisted. Everyone is sick and twisted in their own
different ways. Oh, okay, that's fair.
My point being is that, for instance, I'm not complaining about the graphic nature of the episode. I think they could have been way more graphic, and they could have been less graphic. But I don't think that they pushed any like envelopes too far in this episode. But does that mean that I'm comfortable discussing the minutiae of it? Absolutely not. Mm-hmm. I can sit through it and be traumatized by it, just like everybody else. But sometimes, vividly talking about it and being descriptive about the ins and outs, literally, of what's going on in the episode, really bothered me.
Okay, you did not have to say that, but I understand. Eliza Rockstead writes, I think they did a fantastic job capturing the horror, considering they're adapting a 2 to even 3 season-worthy book into 1. Sam's performance was award-worthy, and he tore my guts out. Lori Hagen Warnica writes, book reader, but love the adaptation. Marion Fontaine, greatly done, read the books and cried watching the show and many tears. Amy Kennedy writes, the hot springs was my favorite part of the entire book. Amy, we love the hot springs. Of course we'd love to see them in there, but we know they can't do everything. Carolyn Conkle Gorger writes, loved it. Would rather the ending had been 2 hours, several things shortened or missed. The scene where Claire helps Jamie with his breakthrough in the hot springs, fantastic job of all the actors. Pamela Ghost Oldham writes, you know what I missed? This is going to sound weird, but it has to do with Claire's strength. In episode 15, she does not kill the wolf. In episode 16, she does not kill the British Redcoats as she and Jamie are escaping from Mechanix. Are we setting her up to be a gentler, kinder Claire? So far, she's been more victim than victor, if you count the actual occurrences. What do you think?
I'm pretty sure she did kill a redcoat, maybe not in that same instance, but when he was trying to rape her. She, in the, I don't know, 5th or 6th episode? It was after the wedding. No, maybe the 8th episode?
8 was when she was taken away.
Well, it was after they were married, because she and Jamie were off pulling around.
The guy who was on top of her.
Yeah.
Oh, in the glen, deserted glades.
Yes.
Okay.
So, I don't think that she.
And she said she was willing to do it when Jenny was torturing that guy, too. She said she would have been willing to do it, because she knew that it would have. I don't know if I believe her, but I think she could have if she had really known what the danger was.
Yeah.
To Jamie and them.
I think it remains to be seen. I think that just because they had to cut those things out, I don't know that necessarily sets up a giant shift in character or not, but we'll just have to stay tuned and find out.
Carol Williamson writes, couldn't read it over the years, can't watch it now. Honestly, some of that could have been left to the imagination. Well, yeah.
I think they still left a lot to the imagination.
I think
there
they
was
did.
Not, I mean, there weren't a lot of extreme close-ups of specific things.
Bits, yes. But also, what they showed us does not mean that that was all that happened. I mean, the breakdown was the most important thing, his breaking Jamie. But I don't think the only thing that happened was what we saw. I think it was there was potentially more.
There was clearly more than that.
Well, you're right, because he tells her in the Abbey, he made me beg, he made me crawl, he made me do that. They didn't show any of that. So, of course, more happened.
They showed the end of the crawl with him on the ground crawling. But it was like, you know, if you go from a scene of him being up over a table,
oh yeah, of course,
and then the next time they go back to there, he's on the ground crawling across the room with BJR sitting on the floor looking at him. I mean, clearly lots of things have happened between point A and point C.
Joy Chrysler writes, incredible finale. I'm a book reader, but started with the series first. I love the rescue, and it was what I pictured in my mind reading the book. I have to applaud Ron Moore and co. for not showing the extent of the brutal abuse that the book depicts, of what Blackjack did to Jamie. The show depicted what happened just enough, but not too much. And it was gut-wrenching to watch. My husband had to walk away, and what first did me in was Claire in the chapel with the monk. When the monk says, "Who says you are alone?" Oh, wow, I cried. When Claire goes to win back his soul, cried and cried. I loved the ending. Running through my mind, I think that the writers did an incredible job with Diana's book. I am so looking forward to next season. Regina Taylor Young writes, so very well done. I can't say more. Waiting now for season 2. Deborah Steinhardt, it was hard to read, but I think it may have been harder to watch. The deep voice that Sam used, it had no life in it. Loved when BJR heard the cow is coming, having absolutely no idea what it was, and seeing his shock. Harrowing and heartbreaking, powerful, and ultimately uplifting. What a ride we are on. Maria Felix says, definitely intense. I found myself muting it and at times turning away. Very powerful performance by these two amazing actors. Lynn McDonald Trent writes, glad he heard he was about to slit Jamie's throat. Elizabeth Meyer, book reader, shivers and tears. And finally from Facebook, Sarah Hooks writes, Shivers, tears, horror, whimpers. I've read the books many times. It was horrifying and very hard to see the brutality, cruelty, and torture brought to life. It's that way in the book. I cry every single time I read it. Seeing how hard Sam and Tobias worked, how much they invested, and how hard shooting this part must have been was incredible. Blackjack is an excellent villain. You hate him so much for a damn good reason. Bravo, Outlander team. You have done such a marvelous job of bringing this amazing story to life. And then 4 or 5 very brief tweets. Laura T. Pelly writes, let's talk about how great Willie is as an original character. Unexpected delight. He so worked. And you were saying you weren't sure if he was actually an original character. He was mentioned, but maybe not fleshed out.
Correct. I do believe there is a Willie in the story.
There are several Willies in the story.
I know, but there is a Willie in the group of men. But I do not believe that he had that fleshed out of a character. Like, I think that they bulked him up and created it.
Ellen Goodman writes of this episode, Sam's exquisite acting along with Tobias. Lori Melchione writes, watched it again for like the 10th time and it never fails to slay me. Susie Oxenham tweets, excellent actors all around. Glad that through the darkness there was light at the end of the episode for our Jamie. And finally, Lisa Richards writes, regarding Willie, says Willie plays an integral part. Can't imagine the ending without him. So we survived a discussion of Outlander finale of season 1, episode 116, To Ransom a Man's Soul. That, I think, wraps up this discussion, the final discussion of season 1.
It wraps up season 1.
Thank goodness this discussion, and not thank goodness season 1. It's been a good, 6-month hiatus plus 2 months, so it's been 10 months. It's been 10 months of a show plus hiatus. So it's been a journey, quite a journey.
And now we're on to Droughtlander 2.0.
Yes, which will be about 10-ish months, something like that.
It's about a year.
Almost
even
a year.
Even if it's April.
Almost, yeah.
Even if it's April, it's going to be at least, that's like just 10. Under 11 months. So. Mm-hmm. Is it wrong to say I'm almost looking forward to it? I need a little bit of a breather after that last episode. I need to regain.
I need a breather after the last 3 months. But after the intensity of the last episode, absolutely. I think we need a breath, a breather, and I look forward to a little bit of a break. I don't know what that means, but a little bit of one.
Well, I mean,
I'm happy to get back to a read-along is all I'm saying. It's much lighter. But, well, not all of it, but...
Dana Gabaldon, it's not always light.
It's rarely light.
And finally, we are thrilled to be able to share the rest of our interview with showrunner Ron D. Moore.
Knowing that male nudity is still somewhat of a hot button topic in the U.S., which episode came as more of a surprise to Outlander's male leads, Lallybroch or Wentworth?
It wasn't really a surprise. I mean, when we cast them, we talked pretty frankly about the book, about what was going to be on the show. They kind of walked in with their eyes open, and we were very frank about it. And we just said, this is the story, and this is where it's going to go. So, you know, I don't think they were surprised at all, really, when we got to those episodes.
Going back just a little bit to the end of season 1, we read on Diana didn't provide the text, but Diana did say that she provided like a written description of what happened at Wentworth so that the writers would know what happened, because in the book it's just referred to in the past tense and we don't get all the details. When all was said and done and the writers wrote and you saw everything and the actors performed everything, do you think the reader, after watching Wentworth and To Ransom a Man's Soul, will be maybe just as shocked by watching it, by not just the fact that it's happening, but the fact that it's maybe being fleshed out before their eyes more so than in the book?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, watching something is just a fundamentally different experience than reading about it. You know, I think there's what your mind's eye fills in and things that you choose not to think about or you gloss over, or even pieces that you do think about and get great, you know, think about in vivid detail, it's just going to be different than what is on screen. It just has to be. So whatever your mental image of these events were, it's not going to be as realized because it can't be, but it will be recognizable. You'll go, oh my God, that's the same story. And you'll be able to like be in the story along with everyone else. But it's just going to hit you in a different way. You know, it's going to be a different experience when you watch it dramatized than it was when you were reading it on the page. So I think even if you know what's coming, I think it's still going to shock. I think it's still going to kind of like, you know, sort of set you back a little bit because it's just different. It's different than reading a description of something and then seeing a photograph of it. You know, it's just completely, you know, a subjective experience.
I had read or heard that you mentioned that you were a fan of, you respected the show Vikings on the History Channel. And one of the things that I think that they did that reminds me of something you just said is while, yes, reading provides, you know, your imagination has to provide what you don't see, any details that are, say, off stage or off screen. One of the things that Vikings did at the end or near the end of season two when Ragnar performed the Blood Eagle, it was so effective because, of course, it was awful to watch, but they didn't really show it. They showed it from the reactions and from the victim's face. And that was, I mean, I was almost ill. That was so effective. That was shocking to me. And they didn't even show that much.
Yeah, no, I agree. And, yeah, they had really, it was very smart because what they had done in that episode is they had given you a very graphic description of it earlier on. You know, they had defined the Blood Eagle, and he had told you a really horrible, you know, detailed account of what it means and what exactly happens to the person that it's done to. So when you got up to that scene, you were just terrified about what you were going to see. And they were very clever in what they did, because you felt like you were seeing much more than you were.
Agreed. It was
unlike in Game of Thrones, where they literally had Daenerys Targaryen eating that heart.
Yeah, it's different. You know, there's just different styles of presentation. There's different, you know, intentions, and you know, it's all about what's the style of storytelling that you're choosing to use as the showrunner, and how do you want to, you know, deliver it to the audience. And yeah, I think those are both valid choices. And I don't think that it's a negative that Game of Thrones goes the way it does. But that's the show that they've chosen to present, and that's the way they go at it. You know, and that's what the audience then expects, and it's fair game. And you watch Game of Thrones, you shouldn't go, oh my God, I can't believe they showed that to me. It's like, this is Game of Thrones. Mm-hmm. This is what we do, you know, and that's part of the reason why people are there. And Vikings, you know, has a different style of storytelling. You know, it's just, they're all just choices.
Going back again to Wentworth, Summer had the question about the male-female nudity. That's an entirely different question, but related. The topic of rape or showing rape, I've, you know, it's part of stories. It's part of, it happens in the world. It's, even if it happens, it's fair game to be part of someone's story. And so we've all, as television, movies, movie watchers, whatever, we've all seen different depictions, whether it was just like in the books, you know, it's past tense and you hear about it, or it's shown mildly or graphically. But I don't know that I've ever seen, let alone read, an account or a scene of male rape. And so I think, do you think that Outlander will kind of be, in another way, quite groundbreaking in what they're choosing, what they're going to be showing?
Possibly. I don't know. I'm not sure groundbreaking is the word I would choose, because that's not really how we thought about it, and that's not really the intention. You're right in that I don't know of another scenes like this that I can recall, or that we, you know, were familiar with or could use as reference or anything. I think we were all sort of aware that this was sort of uncharted territory for what we were doing. And certainly the specifics of the encounter between Jack and Jamie has so much to do with their specific storylines that, you know, it's not like a prison rape from another movie or something, because this is layered with a lot of other different things going on. So no, there really wasn't anything out there to even look for as a reference to sort of, you know, judge ourselves against, or even look to see how somebody else had handled it. Ours is sort of dictated by the parameters of the story in the book, and also by the parameters of the characters as we've drawn them on the TV show and the storylines that we have, you know, shown to the audience at home in terms of Jack, in terms of Jamie, in terms of their relationship in the past and present, and where this all kind of culminates. So we approach the scene from that viewpoint, and having a similar sort of, you know, conversation among ourselves like we did in just Jamie and Claire sex scenes, in that we would say, okay, why are we showing this? What is the purpose of it? How does it advance the story? Why is it necessary to look at this? You know, when I was looking at it in the editing room, I just sort of would decide, you know, I'd listen to people, I'd hear thoughts and comments, but ultimately I would just say, you know, this is a horrible thing. It's happening, and I want to understand it, and I want to be inside it, and I want the audience to feel it. At what point does it become something I can't watch anymore? And at what point does it become something that I've cheated and that I haven't shown enough of? And that's a very completely subjective line, and my job is to kind of find that line. That's sort of what I do, is to say, okay, well, this is the show. And so I looked for the place where, you know, I thought it was brutal and graphic, right up to the point where if we go further, I can't watch it anymore. And that's the point when I would say stop. And again, if I felt like we were shying away from something or cheating it or being coy about it, then I would say, no, we can't cheat that, because that's cheating the experience. It's cheating the story. We have to sort of face what we're doing here and the characters and be honest with what's really happening in this cell. And it's a tough thing. You know, I think we pulled it off, and I'm proud of the actors. They were fearless in their performances. You know, it's tough stuff to do, very difficult, you know, material to realize. Director was up for it. You know, the crew was very sensitive, gave them space. You know, we all just sort of knew that this was a big deal, and we treated it seriously and professionally. And, you know, I think it works, and the audience will be the judge.
Excellent. We look for...
I hate to say looking forward to it, but...
Yeah, I know. That's kind
I'm
of...
looking forward
kind
to
of,
it.
Kind of bad to say I'm looking forward to it, but I kind of am.
I know what you mean. You're looking forward to it and you're dreading it at kind of the same time.
Exactly.
So thank you everyone who tweeted and left a comment on our Facebook post for this episode. We always love hearing from you guys. Feel free to email, tweet. I almost said text, but we haven't given out our cell phone number. thank you, all, as always, so much for listening, and we look forward to our next episode, which will be, what did we decide? It'll be like a roundup of Scotland, or at least a partial roundup.
Don't worry about it. They can find out about it later.
Okay, then. Listen in this weekend, and there'll be some kind of episode for you.
Thank you to our generous audio host, audioboom.com. Our audioboom channel is www.audioboom.com/channel/outlanderpod. Visit our website at www.outlanderpod.com. Follow us on Twitter at @outlanderpod. Find us on Facebook at www.facebook.com/outlanderpod, or email us at outlanderpod@gmail.com.